Welcome to TA1. Everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and then some. I'm your host, legendary Randy Erickson. Excuse me. And flying solo. Birds are downstairs working out. Well, they're watching Paulette work out. Same difference. They're birds. And I think Chili's drinking. Amazing. Just water. So, we have a cool episode with Adam Rose, AR on AR. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Worlds. I don't remember what else we talked about. It was like 2 days ago, so how should I remember? So that's this week's episode, and we hope you enjoy it. Anything, nothing else going on right now? That's like, what, 6 weeks, 7 weeks to C to C? The start to my season. And then it, and it's like monster trucks and sports cars. So I'll be looking forward to all of that coming up soon. So anyway, that's enough. Oh, I got a new one. Slowly is the fastest way to get anywhere. Pretty good. I stole it from somebody, but I don't know who. So yeah, slowly is the fastest way to get anywhere. You know what that means. Be safe. Watch out for alligators. And thanks for listening. And we'll catch up with you in a little while. Bye.
There you go.
That's better. Let me turn this off. There you go. How you doing, man?
Well, better now. Everything's working. So.
Yeah. You're not on the roof today.
Good. No. It is a really nice day again. So, but yeah, yesterday it was like, I need to take advantage and get up there and just do a few little finish up things. And as it turns out, I could have done it today. It's about the same, but yeah. Right. That's the way it goes. Yeah,
well, good. I've just realized that one of the toilets in this house is failed. I've got to go deal with plumbing after this and order some parts, even though, what time is it? It's 7 o'clock at night, but it never ends. And earlier this evening, I was at dusk, I was knocking down walls. But I got to keep the bricks because the bricks are precious bricks. They're not new bricks, they're old bricks. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, the joys of remodeling, right? Remodeling and fixing up.
Yeah. This will never finish, but I don't mind. I like it. I'd rather do that in the day job.
Well, it is the day job here, so.
Yeah, I wish.
Yeah. So what's the day job?
I work in IT, have for the last 20-something years, mostly computer training with corporates. Development and creation of e-learning stuff and delivering webinars and classroom stuff and all sorts of things. So it pays the bills. I know IT, and I know IT because I know computer games. It's a very simple thing.
Well, hey, you know, a lot of people are finding that those computer games will never get you anywhere. Well,
Not true.
They did, didn't they?
not true.
So you should introduce yourself. Who are you?
Yeah, I'm Adam Rose. People might know me from such. What's that guy on Simpsons?
You might know me from such movies as.
Yeah. Troy McClure. It's Troy McClure. People might know me because of obviously the AR and AR YouTube channel. And I'm a South African living in the UK in Wales. And I've been adventure racing since 2009 and doing a lot of outdoorsy stuff all my life. But I'm passionate about adventure racing. Most people know me, know that. And I'll tell everybody and anybody about it. So if nothing else, I get excited by the sport, and I've been listening to you obviously ever since you started your podcast. And I suppose that's my one thing is blabbing on about it to everybody and anybody.
Yeah, that's the the sign of a zealot, right?
Yeah, it's true. You could call me that.
All right. Okay. Before we get into all that, here's the big question: the three most famous people from Wales.
Tom Jones. I'm trying to think. Who's that actor? I'm not the right person to ask these kind of questions. Wait. Who was married to Elizabeth, Liz, what's her name?
Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, was it Tim, it was Burton. Burton, what was it?
Richard Burton.
Wasn't he Welsh?
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. It's a trick question because I have my answer.
And Anthony Hopkins, isn't he?
That may be.
Maybe I'm totally wrong. I can't remember. I should know that, actually. I should know Anthony Hopkins' background.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So also Shirley Bassey.
Oh,
Goldfinger.
Okay. Yeah.
And the most famous of all is Mark Harris.
Ah, really? I didn't know that. Oh, wow. You don't know where in Wales, eh? You just know he's Welsh.
No, I don't. Even if I did, I wouldn't be able to pronounce it. I'm American.
Yeah. There is that. Most English people here, England. Yeah, can't pronounce Welsh names either. Yeah, so you're not alone.
Yeah. Is it just you have to grow up there to know how to which of those letters are silent and which ones you emphasize?
Not really, eh? There's a Kiwi who lives in the same town as me, and he's been here for some time, but he speaks, when I say decent Welsh, I hardly speak any Welsh at all, but the point is, his pronunciation's great, he can converse in Welsh, etc. And in my case, any ability I have to pronounce Welsh comes from my vague background in Zulu from South Africa, because there's some similar sounds. So it is kind of interesting moving here and then, you know, obviously going, oh, okay, I recognize those sounds. So yeah, that's kind of weird. No association.
Yeah, that's interesting. So why did you move South Africa to Wales?
I left South Africa in 1991, the first time, because I was trying to avoid conscription. Back then you had to serve, I think, a year or 9 months to a year. And South Africa was in chaos, you know, it's pre-melt Nelson Mandela's election and everything was crazy. So I went to Hong Kong. I wanted to go to Asia anyway. And I went straight to Hong Kong. I meant to go to Europe first. Like most South Africans, they go overseas if they can, because they feel like they're isolated at the bottom end of South Africa. They want to go and, you know, white South Africans, certainly with a kind of a European background, they want to go and find out what happened in England or something like that. So instead of me going via Europe, I went straight to Hong Kong. And lived and worked in Hong Kong and Taiwan. Went back to South Africa for a couple of years, went back to Taiwan and Hong Kong, and did some media stuff there actually, and was going to cycle from Hong Kong to either London or Cape Town. And in the end, I took a trip home. Like I planned it for a year and a half with my wife, who at that point, we weren't married yet, but, I went to South Africa to visit my family, and they said, oh, why don't you come up to Pretoria, which is far away from Durban where I was, and said, do you want to get this ancestry visa? And I didn't know what this thing was, but it gave me a 4-year visa into the UK instead of just a normal tourist one based on ancestry. And so I said, okay, I'll you know, that's going to be a really useful thing to have in the back pocket. Went and got the visa, and on it said, you have to enter within 6 months or you have to throw this thing away. And I was like, oh, I can't afford to throw away something so valuable. So I trashed that whole 2-year plan of cycling and came straight here. And my wife followed a few months later. So I've been here since 97, literally the month when Hong Kong was handed back to China. So that's how I ended up in the UK anyway. So rather than going Europe to Asia, I went Asia to Europe.
What? Okay, the simple question is why? Why do you want to go all those places? Was it something in you, or is it the culture or, you know, what?
To travel those places?
Yeah, to, yeah.
Yeah. Like I say, a lot of South Africans, when they finish school or finish uni, want to do a gap year. I mean, nowadays it's kind of common to do gap years, but as a white South African, certainly you want to see about this. You want to see what the world's got. You've heard so much about, you know, Europe, America, wherever. So the gap year phenomenon has been a long-standing tradition in South Africa. And me not living there, I mean, you know, it's an incredible place to visit. I always encourage people to visit. Economically, it depends what you do as to whether it's a viable proposition. You know, obviously, Heidi and Stefan are doing a great job.
Yeah. and
I am jealous of the lifestyle that a lot of my friends have who still live in South Africa. But, you know, the UK for a South African is a very easy proposition. You know, nothing to complain about. We might moan about the weather because we're used to something warmer, but in reality, it's very comfortable. And comfort in itself is dangerous, but I've got a family, I've got kids, you know, that kind of stuff. So it makes sense.
Yeah. So it sounds kind of the normal, but was that sort of maybe the beginnings of your adventuring?
But my dad was a wildlife painter, an artist. Yeah. So my whole life, that's all we knew as kids, the three of us kids growing up, was he worked at home in a little wooden shack working by the light of the sun. He'd go down when the sun came up and he'd come back up to the house when the sun went down. And so he had quite an unusual occupation. And every now and again, he'd go into the bush and to look at animals. And we would go with him as family. But because of that occupation, we lived on the edge of a gorge, of a nature reserve, of 5,000 hectares of wilderness with no fences or anything. And there were monkeys and baboons and all sorts of buck, antelope, and even a couple of leopards. So I could literally walk out the bottom of the garden, cross a single strip of tarmac, and be in real bush, real African bush. So my brother and I grew up playing in that as our backyard. And we had all sorts of animals that would come out of that bush into our garden. We had pythons and black mambas and green mambas and spitting cobras and all sorts of crazy stuff. So, you know, we grew up very outdoorsy because of my father and because of the proximity to that bush. And as I've heard on your podcast, a lot of people have a kind of water background, some sort of kayaking or something. And mine was surfing. So I was a BMXer, you know, before 12, 13, 14 years old. I used to race BMX, so I was comfortable on a bike. And then I discovered surfing. And so I grew up very comfortable surfing. Yeah, some pretty interesting surf. And I'm still a surfer, although I don't do much of it anymore. But so that comfort with water. And then the Drakensberg Mountains, where Expedition Africa is featured a few times. You know, there's so many mountains in South Africa. So we'd often go hiking. My brother and I and a couple of friends, we'd go hiking and staying in caves and wild camping and all sorts of things. So it was a background that was very outdoors and lots of different things. Aunt can ask this question. I was in the UK before I heard about adventure racing. And I saw, because I moved here in 97, and I saw the 2000, I think it's 2000, well, I'm tricky on my dates there, but the Borneo Eco Challenge. And I saw that somewhere. And freaked out and thought it was incredible. And like that looks like a dream. But for some reason, didn't research it. You know, I didn't think that there might be smaller races or shorter races. So that would have happened in the early 2000s or mid 2000s that I heard about it. Thought it was way beyond any capacity that I'd ever have. I'm not a Navy SEAL. You know, that was my stereotype, my preconception. And then I think in 2009, I heard about it again. And that... I first heard about a multi-sport race, not even an adventure race, a multi-sport race happening on my doorstep. And I did, it wasn't very hard or complex, but a sprint, equivalent to a sprint. And it was just biking and running, trail running, off-road. And I came almost last on the back of 2 half-mile runs and 1 mountain bike for 20 minutes, something stupid. But, You know, just that outdoor exercise or that competing in a multidiscipline sport went, whoa, this is cool. And that was 2009. And that same year, I started looking at, oh, adventure racing, and the short races in the UK. And so I got into sprint races of a kind of a 6-hour duration. And then coming back to what I said at the beginning, I got a lot of people into the sport because I needed teammates. So I convinced a whole bunch of people to sit down, watch a presentation that I delivered, and then got 4 teams into the next multi-sport race the following month. And some of those guys are still racing today. So this is, you know, this is 2010. And some of those guys are still hardcore racers now. It's just, you know, that's the journey, really.
Yeah. So it's that, you know, stereotypical story. You know, Black Mambas, BMX, surfing, England, adventure racing. It all makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I've heard it all before.
I'm joking, but that is kind of a normal, that outdoor background and that water background, that really seems to be a lot of where a lot of people come from. So, So multi-sport race. So what would have been your first adventure race? Real adventure race.
Well, in that first year, I did this 5-hour sprint race with a friend, and it was by a company called Questars, which the UK teams will know about, down in a place called Poole. And the kayaking was on the harbor, which is the biggest inland natural harbor in the world or something. So it's quite spacious, you know. The point is, it wasn't on a canal or a slow, non-moving lake or river or something like that. So that was kind of interesting. And we did terribly, me and my teammates. We did the biking first rather than the running. And I'd always say, do the running first and get that over and done with. And then we had to get one checkpoint for each discipline. So we did the kayaking fine. We did the biking justice. And then with 20 minutes to go, we came back and got one running checkpoint. And I was starving because I didn't eat properly. So I was literally wolfing down jelly babies, a whole bag of jelly babies. And my teammate was trying to drag me along. But, you know, as a consequence, we weren't disqualified. And it was brilliant. And so there was more of those kind of races. And then that was 2010. And I'm just trying to remember the dates. But I think in 2011... I did something called the Montenegro Expedition Challenge, run by a husband and wife team, a couple in Montenegro, which was incredible. And again, some of the friends I made on that race, I'm still friends with today, from Greece, especially. There was a Greek team. I'm always trying to get people into the sport because, many reasons. Go on about it, but... So the first proper one was this one, and when I say proper, I mean it was a multi-day. I think it is 50-hour race, and Montenegro is a crazy place in Eastern Europe, as in it's got some of the last virgin wilderness of Europe. It's got wolves and bears. It's got this canyon called, the Tara Canyon, which is where the whitewater rafting championships are often held, like the world championships, and it's the second biggest canyon in the world, second only to the Grand Canyon in the States. So it's an incredible location and a small country and not very commercialized at that point, you know, compared to most European countries. So it's Eastern Europe is an amazing place to do adventurism.
Well, some of the people I've talked to and some of the stuff I've seen, it definitely is. Mm. What, if you could send your first year racer self an email, what would you tell yourself before that first 50-hour race? Something you know now.
The message I would send to myself is to be more patient with my teammates, you know. I think that's the trickiest thing for anybody to master is your relationship with your teammates, you know, especially when if you race with people that you don't know well. That's kind of tricky, you know. And it's a great learning curve, but that's the most valuable asset, really.
So, were you able to? I mean, did you have a team back then, or was it pick up? You know, whoever you could con into to this new sport?
They were all friends that I knew from church, by and large, because that's where I had a strong sense of community in the first place. But it was also kind of interesting because these were mainly guys. And, you know, I don't know if you go to church or been to church, but, you know, you build relationships and you see these people maybe once a week or maybe at some home group or something. And you get to know these people and you'd consider them friends and all that kind of stuff. But adventure racing took everything to a new level because, as you know, you get to see the worst of a person and they get to see the worst of you and yet you're friends. So we really got to know each other well. And I remember Donovan Sims talking about this after the expedition, you know, the World Championships in Tasmania. They did, you know, they did that documentary series. And what is it? Wild, I can't remember the name.
Wild Racers?
Yeah, Wild Racers. That's on Amazon Prime nowadays, I think. And I remember when they did the Tasmania one, they were talking about it's like the closest thing that they could describe to being at war, you know, the closest and the kinship you develop with a band of people. So I've continued to race with those people since those early days. You know, some of the best friendships I've developed in the UK have been with those people. Still solid.
So then, So then that, you know, I have to ask my question. I'm going to rephrase this a little bit, but are there things that you've done racing that your teammates know about that your wife doesn't?
there's nothing funny that's going on, but we both heard of people getting, they either get married and go adventure racing or they go adventure racing and then get married, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it is it is a very healthy way to find out how well you know your potential spouse, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of in Afrikaans, there's an expression that if a couple are going to get married, they should first eat a bag of salt together. That's what it translates as. And, you know, adventure racing is more intense than that, but the same experience. You know, if you get through that, then you probably get through most things.
Yeah. It's very, very true. How long did you have to race before you felt confident?
Us South Africans are full of bombast and opinions and brashness. We have the reputation. I have noticed that most South Africans who I know personally who race tackle it quite, you know, like quite boldly and don't go in with much doubt, which isn't necessarily a good idea because we can make stupid mistakes. But so right from the word go, like the guys I got into it, by and large, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them didn't have a lot of outdoor experience. So, you know, they would lean on me as an, oh, you know this stuff. You've done rock climbing before. You've done surfing before, whatever. I mean, so regardless of age, and some of them are older than me, they didn't have an issue with me sometimes being the captain, right? I would quite easily, quite happily take being captain and maybe nav as well, or second nav, first nav. So as I started in 2009, even that first one in Montenegro, the first proper one, shall I say, multi-day one, you know, I was stoked. I was confident. I knew I had a nav and it was great. You know, my teammate and I had a bit of a falling out because he kind of threw the towel in at one point. We're great friends. There's not an issue. But I'd say the first, I did another one in Slovenia with some of those guys from the church. That was great, great learning curve, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think the first AROWS one in Spain that I did was 2013, was the Raid Bembash Extreme. You know, that was the first time I'd done a race that went on over 100 hours. And that's an eye-opening experience and seeing so many sunrises and sunsets, it was incredible. So yeah, that's the one that kind of, you feel solid after that.
It is, yeah. So what's like your favorite distance for racing?
Multi-day. I prefer a long expedition. But I'll take what I can get because, you know, life is complicated. We've got day jobs, we've got family and, you know, wife, kids and all that kind of stuff. And in my case, this house that I'm going to be restoring forever. So I'm just stoked to do whatever, which is why I've recently, as I posted recently on YouTube, you know, starting to create races for bunches of teams where, you know, it's very low budget, but everybody has an incredible time. So, you know, that,
So what makes you, other than say like timing, because timing can be huge when you're picking a race, right? I mean, it's got to work out. What do you like? What do you want to see in a race that you do? Yeah. Like really tough navigation, lots of paddling. What's your dream race?
My dream race is off piste. Mm-hmm. So the wilder the better. So I really wanted to do Expedition Africa Lesotho this year because that's an old school race. I mean, the Raid Gaulois ran through there, the same area in Lesotho, in Lesotho certainly, you know, way back in the 90s, late 90s, mid 90s, somewhere there. So I don't want to see people. I don't want to see, if I can help it, I don't want to see even paths on the ground. So I'm happiest on a, let's say on a trekking leg where there are no trails and, you know, you have as many route options as you can make. So, you know, coming back to those 5,000 hectares at the bottom of the garden, we would, what we call here, in the States, you call it bushwhacking. And in South Africa, we call it bundu bashing, exactly the same thing. But I'm happiest bundu bashing up cliffs, down ravines, through complete wilderness. And I also want it to be dry and warm. So I live in the UK, which is not so dry, not so warm. But that's why I tend to race more. The longer races, I tend to race overseas more, where I can go somewhere dry and warm rather than freezing and wet and cold.
Yeah. So you probably didn't get much of what you enjoyed in Spain at Worlds.
Yeah, that was interesting. Hey, nice segue that.
Thank you.
No, it's great. RWC Spain was a different kettle of fish. You know, I've listened to some of the other interviews you've done about that, and the one thing to point out for people who weren't there is that the undergrowth in Spain, in that area of Spain certainly, is very dense. So not only were there lots of trails that have obviously been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years, it's also very, very dense off trail. So you didn't have much in the way of navigation in that you could just tag a line through wherever. A lot of it is gorse, and you know, gorse is very prickly, spiky, thorny kind of undergrowth, and you don't want to bundu bash through that stuff. So that made it fairly predictable once you got your head, you know, around how Pablo designs his courses. And then obviously in that first trekking leg, there was some horrendous weather that first night. I mean, that was blowing so hard. I had to turn my head sideways and I had my head torch, obviously, in the middle of the night. I could see the spray coming off the peak on my hood. And I could barely see because the spray was so strong. And we were right on the top at one point when it was incredible. You know, it really was interesting. But the latter part of the race, the weather was great. So it was just that first night that really kind of was the worst. It got progressively better. You've just frozen, so I can't hear you. It's still recording though. Knock, knock. I'm just going to check that there isn't a connection problem on my side. No, I'm great. Okay. Can you hear me? Hello, hello. Can't hear you.
Yep.
There we go.
Now you can.
No, now I can. Okay.
I dropped out for some reason.
Yeah, no worries.
But did you enjoy Worlds? No, it wasn't you, of course.
Okay. I did. I mean, the event was awesome. Being back at a proper race was awesome. The community, the atmosphere was great. Big hat off to Pablo for pulling it off despite COVID. And as far as I know, nobody picked up COVID there, right? So that was incredible. I think, you know, because the team that I was in, we didn't do the full course. And I spoke to a bunch of teams, obviously in the same boat as our team. And so I think for the teams who managed to do the full course, it really stretched them. And, you know, as in, it was a tough event, a tough race. And although it wasn't the hardest navigation, they appreciated the journey. But I think teams that didn't do the full course, you missed out on quite a substantial experience, which would most likely in our case with a lot of other teams was that big kayaking leg down the river, which was incredible. I would love to have done that. And then the second big mountain biking leg, which wasn't wasn't such a big deal if you missed it. It wasn't as interesting as the first mountain biking leg. But as a consequence, speaking to a lot of teams, those of us who short course like that got quite a lot of time off our feet because we were bussed from the beginning of the kayak stage. We missed out the kayak, missed out the mountain bike, went to the next trekking stage. And then we had to wait for the first five teams to pass us before we could resume. And, you know, in our case, that was an 18-hour wait, I think. Something like that, you know, 15 to 18 hours. And that's a long time in the middle of a race to be doing nothing. And some teams, you know, even longer than that, 24 hours doing nothing. So speaking to teams after the race finished, in the same boat as ourselves, having missed out the middle, and there were a bunch of teams who felt like I did, which was, yes, we loved it in some, you know, some aspects of it, but we also felt it hadn't pushed us the way it could have because we had this huge break in the middle. So I think, and so there were mixed feelings. A lot of these short course teams were like, I didn't feel I was broken. I didn't feel like I was stretched to the nth degree, and it is a world championship. So, you know, but it, yeah, you know, if we'd gone faster, we could have done the kayak. It's on us.
Well,
it's
there is that. Yeah.
One way to look at it.
Was it, you know, if you get a break like that, 18 hours, is it hard to get back into the race mode, or are you just in an adventure mode then? Because you're not, you know, what do you feel like?
When we resumed, we were raring to go, and all the short course teams that I saw were raring to go. So, you know, people had a proper rest in some form or another, these teams, and nobody was groaning to get up, other than maybe their feet had been trashed, as you heard from all the tarmac in the first stage, and that was a very tough opening first stage. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. It was still fun, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the bottom line. It's fun.
Well, the team I was racing with was, I'd never raced with them before, and that was their first expedition race, and only their second adventure race. And the previous adventure race they did was in July, which was the race that I organized. So they entered the Worlds as their first adventure race. So hats off to them, right? And, you know, they crossed the finishing line under their own steam. They all had backgrounds that weren't adventure racing, but certainly, you know, some triathlon stuff and some ultra marathon type stuff. And, you know, they were really tough mentally because two of them, the husband and wife, Anton and Julie, got terrible feet on the first stage. And, you know, they had huge blistering and kind of second skins and terrible. And yet they crossed the finishing line. So, you know, they did an amazing job to enter a world and cross the finishing line despite all that. Yeah, it was very impressive.
So here's a question. Out of your three teammates, are they going to race again?
All three of them are entered for Expedition Africa Lesotho.
Okay, so they're real adventure racers. They jumped in big time and went for it.
Yeah. Anton, who was the captain, said it was unfinished business at Worlds. You know, he wants to do the full course like anybody does. The one reservation I have is his wife, Julie, doesn't handle the cold very well, by her own admission, right? It's no secret. But you know, Lesotho is going to be colder because that's going to be 2,000 to 3,000 meters for the whole race. So I hope they do some cold preparation beforehand. It could be quite,
it could be. Yeah. So, AR on AR, where'd that come from?
Since university, like while I was at university, my part-time job was working in film. Sometimes behind the camera, sometimes in front of the camera. There were a lot of B-grade American films made in South Africa as a tax write-off, where the government would pay for every movie that failed in South Africa, produced by an overseas company, every movie that failed, for every dollar that was invested, the South African government would pay them $3. So it was insane. They didn't think it through. So for a few years, they were making over 200 films a year in South Africa. And America's only 300 odd films a year. So it went, the film business went crazy. And I was working in that. And I've been involved with film and TV ever since. So that's, you know, since my early 20s, my late teens, and documentaries and TV and whatever, whatever. When I was in Hong Kong, when I was in wherever, UK, and I've done some work all over. But so for me to make it a YouTube channel is an obvious thing. It's like, okay, I know how to handle that kind of stuff. And I don't mind being in front of a camera. And it all comes back to what I said in the beginning, is that I love telling people about adventure racing and I want to help them. And if my day job is helping people with computers. So I'm comfortable speaking to people and communicating and hopefully speaking in a clear and concise way, explaining difficult concepts. So when it comes to adventure racing, look, nobody's doing this on YouTube in any committed sense. So, and I wanted to do it, you know, once we knew that Amazon Prime was going to be doing the Eco, it was like, well, this is the best time ever to get something out with what is certainly going to be a new audience or a bigger audience. So that's why I jumped in and I managed to get the first episode out just before, like literally 2 days before Amazon Prime showed Eco. And it's been an interesting journey doing it, but I wish there were more hours in the day, you know, like everything else.
Yeah, I hear you there.
Yeah.
So what's the response been to it? Are you, I guess better question is, are you happy with the response?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's a very niche channel, as we know, the sport is. And the response right from the word go has been positive, has been supportive. If anything, I haven't been churning out as much material as I'd like, which is just is what it is. Life is like that. But what was really weird, and this is just a silly thing, is when I went to Worlds, there were people there who knew me, obviously, from the channel who I hadn't met before. So one or two people said, hey, hi, Adam. I'm like, ah, this is so funny. You know, can I take a photo with you? Ah, too funny, too funny. But I mean, that's nothing. It's been good to, most of all, I suppose, like anything, is getting the feedback that the time and energy one puts into something is beneficial to other people. And they turn around and say, that was useful, you know? So the feedback is great because the whole purpose of the channel is to help people. And if I'm not getting any response and I'm not managing to help people, then what's the point of doing it? So the enthusiasm or encouragement I get is obviously helps me to get off my butt and actually produce something.
Yeah, I get that. But I'm not going to lie, it's kind of cool when you're someplace. And so my story is I'm at Worlds in Australia talking to somebody, and his team came up and said, are you Randy? Because they knew my voice.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hey, being a celebrity and being a celebrity, a D-list celebrity, a niche sport isn't all bad.
No, I mean, it's just funny. And also, like, even at Worlds, there were at least three separate teams where people said to me, specific responses to certain episodes I've done on AR on AR. Like, whoa, I've tried out this thing you suggested and it works. Whoa! And I'm like so stoked, you know, because that's a face-to-face response as opposed to somebody writing a message or an email or something. So I even went to Worlds as a result of the channel, because that's how that team got to hear about me. And they needed somebody who knew adventure racing, and none of them had done it. So that's how I got into that team in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's a good benefit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you have a master plan of episodes, or do you just wing it?
No, I have. I have a spreadsheet with, and I'm always adding new episodes to it. So like, oh, I've got to do this one and I've got to do that one. And it's sometimes it'll be in response to people asking me questions on YouTube, you know, like, hey, what about that? And I'll do that. Or it's just obviously concepts and ideas and stuff like that. So I have a huge list. I think it's not a stumbling block, but just the irritation I have is that I don't have somebody to work with. Because if I had like a cameraman or something, and I know a bunch of people, but none of them live in Wales. And they all live back near London where I used to live, who I could collaborate with. And then that would speed up the production so much because I wouldn't have to be shooting everything myself and then checking. And the number of times I've shot an episode, and then when I've got back to edit it, something's slightly out of focus or slightly mispositioned. And I checked, you know, I thought I checked. Or the sound isn't quite right. I'm like, got to reshoot that whole episode. And it's time consuming. So
I think that's I used to say I don't think people know how much work goes into it, but I think a lot of people kind of figure out now that it's just not a matter of sticking up a camera and talking.
Not if
that's
you want
the
to
easy
come
part.
Reshoot. retake. Oh man, I'm not
well,
gonna
do that's podcast. Even easy. Yeah, that's even kind of the easy part. It's the sitting there and editing and which I like. I would guess you probably like it too, because otherwise you wouldn't do any of it. But you probably like me. Sometimes you get that look like, are you still working on that thing?
Here's a question: do you procrastinate about your editing?
No.
Woo-hoo! Well done.
No. No, and here's why, because the stuff I do is the Ray stuff needs to be out right away.
Yeah.
Where I don't say you don't have a time frame, but you don't.
I know.
You know, if the Ray stuff isn't out like the next day, who cares, right?
Yeah, I mean, mine's self-imposed. But when you go and shoot these like car races, you know, the Baja, whatever, are you shooting that and then putting out dailies, or you're producing a finished product?
No, it's, I think it's all daily stuff anymore.
Okay.
Nobody wants to look at anything later, you know, how it goes.
Yeah.
The stuff I'm doing this year with the sports cars is like, you know, I should probably do an overall arcing season thing.
Yeah.
Cause I'm going to be shooting 20 weekends of racing. And then I'm like, okay, I could do that. I could get the footage, you know, each weekend. And then I'm like, but who's going to watch it? It doesn't say Red Bull or GoPro on it. Who's going to watch it?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, I mean, but hats off to you for not procrastinating, because that's one of my weaknesses.
Well, the other thing, the other thing that I think in the last year or so is just the live stuff. iPhone live stuff right there really, really hits with people. And even when it's just stupid stuff like me, you know, me standing there saying nothing's going on.
Yeah.
But it's two different kinds. It's really two different media. What AR and AR is, and what race coverage is. So you know videos, and you make videos. Do you carry a camera where you race? And if you do, have you ever used it?
I since my first race, right? I've always had some form of camera on me. I've always taken photos or videos, increasingly more video nowadays. So I have a video for Worlds that I haven't finished editing. Over the 5 odd days that we were racing, I took a few hours worth of footage in total on a GoPro, combined with stills. And, you know, the stills aren't bad, but the video there. And so I've always been the guy with the media on every team that I've raced in. And then what's funny is that usually at the end of the race, whatever I produce will always show everybody else. So my teammates over the years have said, yeah, oh, you never in the videos. And it's because they're not filming and they're not interested in filming. But sometimes I'll say, hey, give me the camera so that they can, because they feel guilty that I'm taking all this footage of them. But it's always me with the camera in one way or another. And so the team will get ahead of me while I'm trying to compose a shot. You know, then I got to run to catch up and get ahead of them. Yeah, I mean, it's normal, but...
Yeah. I always chuckle when people say, well, you should just give a camera to every team in a race, and you'll have this great... And it's like, I've done it... I've given at least a dozen teams a camera in a race, but I've never got a second of footage. I take that back. One time I did. Ron England from Florida actually shot some stuff, so shout out.
Is most of it just unusable, or they don't bother shooting?
They don't even get the camera out. I mean, they're racing. That's not, you know, I totally get it. Mm. You know, and sometimes I still will, even now, will say, here, take this. If you use it, you use it. It's not. So, but I sure don't ever expect anything.
Well, I mean, I found interesting Kilian Jornet, the ultra runner, you know, when he's running and he's been winning races like the Western States 100, he'll stop and take photos. And if he says, if he doesn't do that as the winner, if he doesn't do that, then he's missing the point of the race. So he'll be taking selfies and stopping to look at the sunrise. And yet he's leading, you know, you'd think he'd be totally focused on that. So, you know, it is possible for people at the cutting edge to take footage if they really want to, I suppose, if they want to.
Yeah.
I'm certainly nowhere near that, but I love to take it. I love to take stuff.
Well, I think someone like Kilian, I mean, literally that's their job. Running is their job, but also social media is their job. I mean, that's why they're getting paid.
And
no adventure racer is getting paid. So take pictures. What do you think? So what do you think the goal of adventure racing should be? I'll give you my example. I've said this before. I think that what adventure racing in especially America should be is, if the top three teams didn't have to spend any of their money to race. You know, they're never going to get paid. You know, they're never going to be professional. But if sponsor would say, here's money to go race, I think that would be a pretty good win. So what do you think it should be, or where could it be?
My hope is that globally there's more grassroots adventure racing in the schools. I mean, a lot of, you know what it's like in New Zealand, where they cultivate it, with the Hillary Challenge and all sorts of other things. In South Africa, they used to have a national series, you know, across all the schools and everything. I know in France, they're very good at that. In Canada, they were looking at a school series. I don't know if they've got that off the ground. They probably have, and I just don't know about it. You know, I think for me, the thing that separates adventure racing from, let's say, Xterra, which is multi-sport, which is off trail. I mean, it's trail running and all that kind of stuff, is the adventure aspect. And that's because of the navigation. So, you know, I'm more interested in adventure than I am in racing. And obviously I'm not a podium level team, but I race as hard as I can when I do race. So I don't take it casually. And all the teams I've raced with have all tried to do as hard as they can, knowing that they're never going to be near the podium. But for me, adventure is, and there's two, it's a two-part question, because adventure is the essential ingredient. And if an adventure race doesn't have an adventurous component, if it starts feeling too much like a triathlon, then I think it loses something vital. But then the glue that holds adventure racing together is the relationship side of thing, the fact that it's a team-based sport primarily, although we know people can race solos, but it's the relationship in adventure, because the incredible experience of adventure racing shared is so much better than doing everything solo where you can't talk to anybody because they weren't there with you. So that shared experience. So coming back to your question really about, you know, how high will adventure racing ever go? Will they ever do that, like sponsor the top three teams in a country? Well, we know what it was like in the 90s, you know, when there was real money behind the top teams. Yeah. It was semi-professional at the very least, and there was real prize money. But you can still get the prize money in China nowadays, you know, outside COVID. Yeah. I mean, they have real money involved. So people can earn, can be professional athletes, although not exclusively in adventure racing. And you know, if we look at Bear Grylls himself fronting the Eco Challenge, that was so useful in bringing people who followed followed Bear Grylls to then discover adventure racing. But the reason they follow Bear Grylls in the first place, whether you like him or not, whether you think he sits in hotels or not, is because Bear Grylls, with all his kind of over the topness in what he does, shows kids what adventure's like. Yeah. Even if some of the stuff he does is foolhardy, but it's for a camera, right? But it's adventure, and adventure is missing. Real adventure is missing from so many kids' lives and adults as well, right? So as long as whatever form adventure racing goes or develops, or if there's real money or not real money, as long as people get to explore and experience real adventure, like the whole reason that adventure racing was given birth was to kind of do a Dr. Livingstone, I presume, going down the Nile, you know, kind of that kind of age of exploration, trying to capture that experience. That's a very convoluted answer to your question, but it's there is some money. Will we ever get national teams being sponsored? That's a dream. That'd be incredible. But as long as there's a real adventure, I think people will always be drawn to it, no matter how much.
Okay. Here's the hardest, simple question I'll ever ask. It's just a yes or no, and just a yes or no answer. But will there be another Eco Challenge?
Yes.
Okay.
Will Amazon pay for it?
You heard
no.
It?
No.
So that's pretty cool. All right. So taking up a lot of your time, and I theoretically should be working. But what's on your agenda for the year? What's coming up? 2022, I think that's where it is.
I was supposed to be doing Raid in France because I was signed up for it last year. And then that got postponed because of COVID. And then immediately after that, I got into a team through the AR on AR channel to do ITERA. And then that got postponed. And then I got into ARWC with the other team. And that actually happened. Point is that this year, in theory, I should be doing Raid in France because now it's actually happening. But the team that I was in, we kind of injuries and complications, so that's not going to happen. And then ITERA, the team that I was in for ITERA at this point is not doing ITERA this year. And I really, as I say, wanted to do Expedition Africa Lesotho because the terrain means a lot to me because I've done a lot of adventuring in Drakensberg. But I don't have any multi-day race scheduled for this year, much as I'd love to. And at the moment, the only firm things on my calendar are some of these self-made 24-hour races. And I hope I get to do an expedition race this year, but if I don't get to do an expedition race this year, it'll be tragic for me just because I'm selfish. But if not that, then I know some stuff about 2023. And I'm holding out for that. I know some stuff which I can't talk about, but it gets me very, very excited. So if it's not this year, it's next year for sure. Woo! I wish I could talk.
That would normally be a good place to stop. But do you, I mean, you're not old, but you kind of like feel like the clock's ticking and you want to do a whole bunch of races. And it's like, it sucks when you miss a year.
Totally. I'm 53, right? Going 54. And I only started, it would have been in my 40s, my early 40s, like 42 or whatever it was. So I definitely feel the clock is ticking. And although my fitness isn't terrible, you know, I'm fine. You know, my fitness, I just looked at my VO2 max the other day, like, oh, that's not bad. I do feel in my best expectation is to do at least one expedition race a year. And because I've been working on this house for so many years, I took a break from literally 2016 to 2020 with no races, no multi-day races. I was doing other stuff, but all the energy and time and money went into the house. So now I'm hopefully getting back into expedition racing and trying to balance everything, you know?
Well, maybe somebody will listen to this and say, hey, you're not a Brit, you're not a Welshman, are you a South African? What are you?
Yeah,
we need one of them.
Yeah. speak to my team. We went to the Worlds, and they'll give you the best advice about
okay.
that. Yeah. No, that's cool. I'm always keen to race, that's for sure. We'll see. Hopefully by the end of this year, I'll be able to turn around and say, Randy, I did this crazy race.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. So
yeah.
So okay, that's a good place to stop. I really appreciate it. And I love it when people come on and just want to talk about it. So I don't have to say anything. So you're the perfect guest.
I talk too much. But never stop. Thanks very much.
This is a podcast. All it is talking. So you're perfect.
Yeah, man. Cool. Keep on doing what you're doing.
All right. Thanks. See you later.
See you later, man.
See you someday.
Yeah. Bye. In person, man. Cheers.
I'll take you there.
Won't
I'll take you there, you there. I'll take you there, you there.
Let me take you there.
I'll take you there, you there.
Amen.
I'll take you there.
People keep on asking, where did you get the wings to fly?
I'll take you there.
From our hometown in Ladysmith, in KwaZulu Natal, around the world.
Take you there.
For with God, nothing shall be impossible.
Take you there.
We invite you,
take you there.
To join us. In spirit, in love, peace, and harmony. South Africa. America. Europe. Australia. Russia. Japan. We want to give you the keys to heaven. Jerusalem. Salvation for everyone. We will take you there. Be free. Kululeka.
I'll take you there.
Free. Kululeka.
I'll take you there. I'll take you there. I'll take you there.
Thank you for my mind.
Oh, yes.
Hallelujah. 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 I said, hallelujah.
Thank you.